This episode is brought to you by Podcast Assist, offering voiceovers, audio editing and mastering, transcriptions and show notes, episode summaries, and even hosting a podcast on a topic important to you. Visit facebook.com/podcastassist for more info on their flat $30 per hour rate.
I was thinking that we could do this better. We could do this better now.
I'm Chance Dorland, and this is the Des Moines FM Podcast. You can subscribe in the iTunes Store with Stitcher, Audio Boom, Overcast, or your favorite podcasting app. And also, leave us a comment or let us know your opinion on this or any other topic by recording a voicemail message on our website, DesMoinesFM.com. 2004's What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America spent 18 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list due to its telling of the rise of populist, anti-elitist conservatism in Kansas as well as the United States. But now one history professor is asking, what's the matter with Iowa? Colin Gordon is a history professor at the University of Iowa and recently penned an article by that name for Dissent magazine. And he joins me now to discuss his writing that begins with the charge that the blueprint that was used in Scott Walker's Wisconsin and Sam Brownback's Kansas is now being unrolled in Iowa, as well as in South Carolina, Kentucky, and New Hampshire. So, Professor Gordon, thank you for joining me. Let's start with that piece of writing from 2004 and then get to your recent article for Dissent magazine. Could you just describe some of the themes of What's the Matter with Kansas and why those are still relevant today?
Yeah, I think Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas makes a slightly different argument than I make regarding our current circumstances. So Frank argued in his 2004 book that the working class in states like Kansas was being mobilized around social issues like abortion and gay marriage, but that the agenda of the governments that were then elected was largely involved sort of economic damage that was then visited on those voters. So it was a sort of elaborate bait and switch. I don't really see that happening in states like Iowa or in Scott Walker's Wisconsin in recent years. It's really not much misdirection in terms of trying to mobilize voters around social issues. It's a fairly straightforward, although I think largely hidden economic agenda, largely aimed at lowering business costs, lowering taxes, lowering wages, and generally providing benefits that would flow upwards to the 1%.
So you're now kind of talking about this blueprint that you mentioned in your piece for Dissent magazine from Scott Walker's Wisconsin, as you just mentioned. You say it's still being used today, but now in Iowa, as well as a few other states. So let's expand on that. What is this blueprint that they followed in Wisconsin that you're now seeing in Iowa and elsewhere?
Well, the right has been very active really for a generation in trying to mobilize an economic agenda in the states. And the lead organization here is an organization called ALEC, or the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has been, it's a sort of membership-based organization with a largely business clientele that then also signs up state legislators, offers them training, offers them draft language for bills, model legislation, which is mostly coming from those corporate interests, that are then pressed at the state level. And it's really just a sort of cookie-cutter template. A colleague of mine at Columbia, Alex Hertel Fernandez, who studied Alex quite closely, has actually used plagiarism software to sort of compare the language in bills introduced from one state to the next, to the model legislation that's proposed by ALEC.
And I'm guessing if that legislation had been submitted in your colleague's class or your class, it would not pass the plagiarism test?
Well, but plagiarism is a little harsh. There's nothing wrong with copying legislation from one state to another. There's nothing illegal about it. But I think in this case, it does underscore that the source of the legislation is coming from a well-funded national organization and not from Iowa legislators or their constituents.
As you mentioned a little earlier, as opposed to the book, What's Wrong with Kansas, you don't see so much of a bait and switch with what's happening in Iowa and those other states that we mentioned at the beginning of the conversation. If that's the case, and you know, your piece in Dissent magazine certainly seems to make the point that these new pieces of legislation that are coming from the GOP in Iowa, which now has a trifecta, so the two houses of government as well as the governorship, if they're not trying to fool people into what they're doing, but if what they're doing is so negative for Iowans, why are Iowans voting for them? In the past few years, especially rather recently, they seem to be doing just that.
Well, it's an interesting question. And I think the answer to it is relatively simple. No one ran on this agenda. No one campaigned on the importance of lowering the minimum wage or cutting business taxes or ending collective bargaining in Iowa. You know, they ran on, you know, what was a sort of, you know, peculiar 2016 election cycle, which is very much dominated by national issues. You know, you have sort of disproportionate representation of rural districts in a state like Iowa, which is also reflected in the national results. So unlike the situation that Thomas Frank describes, where there's really an effort to sort of whip up voters around one set of issues and then legislate on another set of issues, here the agenda, I think, is really just hidden. You run on a sort of very sort of straightforward partisan political plank. But no one, as I say, campaigned on the basis of the legislation that was then rushed into play as soon as the legislator came into session.
And so is it your opinion as a professor of history that had there been, if you will, more transparency on the goals that we're now seeing being played out in the State House in Iowa during the campaign season, that perhaps the voting would have been different?
Well, I think, the evidence for that is fairly clear in the reaction to the collective bargaining bill. I mean, when legislators went back to their home districts, there's very little support for this legislation. You know, particularly in rural parts of the state, jobs in public education and in state government are often the only really sort of decent jobs in the county. Public education is very important to Iowans, and I think if the Republicans had explicitly run on a campaign of lowering funding for public education and undermining collective bargaining, that they wouldn't have won.
And so as things move forward in Iowa, this trifecta obviously isn't going to end anytime soon. There will be a governor's race in 2018 that will be rather interesting because you'll have basically an incumbent who stepped into the shoes of the governorship and wasn't elected into that position directly. Things might change a little bit. But concerning things right now, I assume you don't think anything is going to change. I mean, the GOP is in the driver's seat in the state of Iowa, and I'm guessing you expect more of the same of what we've already seen.
So the collective bargaining was the first blow, and the next thing through the legislature, which may come as early as today, is preempting local action on minimum wages and other labor standards. There's also a move to sort of gut the workers' compensation system in Iowa, although it works very well in the state. And we may see more action on lowering taxes, particularly business taxes and property taxes, fairly soon. This will in turn sort of exaggerate the state's fiscal woes, which will lead to more demands for cutting spending, particularly on healthcare and education, which is the bulk of the state budget.
And then specifically, I'm interested, you know, as you are a professor at the University of Iowa focusing on history, you have quite a few options available to you when it comes to writing, either for publications or for research, you know, anything that you do as a professional in your position. Why specifically did you choose to write this piece in Dissent magazine, once again, titled What's the Matter with Iowa? Is this do you think that this is just something you care so much about? Do you think that people just don't understand what's happening in Iowa? And perhaps if they learn more about it, they might change their voting patterns in the future. What's your end goal with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fairly accurate description. I mean, I study the history of public policy, both at the federal and at the state level. And so this is of interest to me as sort of history in the making. I also serve as a research consultant to the Iowa Policy Project, which is a nonpartisan research group based in Iowa City, a sort of a state-level think tank. And we're very active on these sorts of issues, on what the state tax system should look like, the benefits of raising the minimum wage. And so I've done not just historical research, but policy research in these areas. It's also true, I think, that we can learn a lot from the experience of other states. And so as an academic, I have the luxury of studying, you know, what has occurred elsewhere, what has occurred in the past in other states. And, you know, we do have the examples of Sam Brownback's Kansas and Scott Walker's Wisconsin, the economic prospects of which have not been terribly positive since the political revolutions in those two states.
That's a really interesting point to bring up. I guess if the question in your article is, or the title of your article, rather, you know, what's wrong with Iowa? I think it's probably safe to say the answer that you're implying with your writing is, you know, the GOP, the Republican Party that has this trifecta. But what's the solution then? Is Iowa just going to have what you just described from some of these other states that experienced something like this previously? Or perhaps might there be, in at least in your mind, a brighter future that could take place in Iowa? Maybe if more people like yourself get the word out and try to convince some voters.
Yeah, I mean, I think the proof is in the pudding. The fact that the single strongest argument for this agenda is that it will make the state more attractive for business investment, and that this will yield economic growth, and that this will yield higher wages and higher incomes. The problem with that reasoning is that we know from examples in our own past and from examples in other states that it doesn't work that way, that business investment is not looking for simply the lowest tax rate or the lowest wages. They're looking for a well-educated labor force. They're looking for a decent infrastructure. They're looking for cities and neighborhoods in which their employees and themselves can live safely. You know, business are attracted to higher road sort of opportunities and climates. And so this race to the bottom is not in either the short or the long term a constructive strategy.
Do you think members of Iowa's Republican Party would disagree with you on that? Or do you think, I guess, to be very frank, deep down, maybe they even might agree with that, but they want to do what they want to do for whatever reasons they have?
Oh, I have no doubt that, you know, many of the Republicans who are were responsible for this legislative agenda believe quite sincerely in that basic argument that dismantling government and starving the public sector and lowering taxes will yield greater investment. I just would reiterate that, you know, the historical and cross-state evidence suggests that that's not the case. I think the other important point to make here, particularly in a state like Iowa, is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, these ideas are coming from outside of Iowa, and they're in a sense being imposed upon us. And I think the reason that Republican legislators grasp onto them is really twofold. Some of them certainly believe in the agenda. But it's also true that in smaller states that have part-time legislatures, that members of the legislature, particularly new members of the legislature, are attracted to any organization that's offering them resources and ideas. And so ALEC, in a sense, sort of fills that breach and provides, you know, draft language on bills. Here's the way it was done in other states. It provides a set of resources for those legislators, which I think is quite attractive.
And then, Professor, You're such a wealth of knowledge on this topic. We could probably go on forever, but I just want to give you the opportunity. Anything else that you want to add that we haven't spoken about yet specifically, or some finer points that you'd like to make before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, I mean, to the degree that there's a there's an element of sort of bait and switch in the policies, I think it's really between the sort of fiscal logic, the idea that, you know, the state is running out of money and therefore we have to make these cuts, and the rest of the legislative agenda. And I think it's very important to emphasize that in a state like Iowa, the fiscal situation is not at all dire. And to the degree that we're struggling to raise revenue, it's largely of the legislature's own doing in cutting taxes and giving large refundable tax credits to often very profitable out-of-state businesses. So, you know, one argument for this kind of agenda is that we will galvanize business investment. Another argument is that we don't have the money to do what we want. And that's simply not true.
I've been speaking with Professor Colin Gordon, a history professor at the University of Iowa. And as I mentioned recently, penned an article by the name What's the Matter with Iowa for Dissent magazine. Thank you for speaking with me, Professor. And I'd love to have you on the show again sometime down the road.
Yeah, thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
I'm Chance Dorland, and you've been listening to the Des Moines FM podcast. You can subscribe in the iTunes store with Stitcher, Audioboom, Overcast, or your favorite podcasting app. And as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, leave us a comment. Let us know your opinion on this or any other topic by recording a voicemail message on our website, DesMoinesFM.com. This episode is brought to you by Podcast Assist, offering voiceovers, audio editing and mastering, transcriptions and show notes, episode summaries, and even hosting a podcast on a topic important to you. Visit facebook.com/podcastassist for more info on their flat $30 per hour rate.